CityTalk 105.9 official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. CityTalk 105.9.
Good morning and welcome to CityTalk's business with me, Frank McKenna. I'm the chairman of the Independent Private Sector Lobby Group and Business Networking Club, Downtown Liverpool in business. And every Sunday, I'll be taking a look at some of the week's big business stories and talking to some key personalities, decision makers and entrepreneurs who work in and influence Liverpool and the wider northwest region. And what a week it's been. A row has broken out over the decision of new City Council leader Joe Anderson going full time. I'll be talking to the man himself a little later on. Elsewhere, the government announced the scrapping of the regional development agencies and Business Link. They will be replaced by Local Enterprise Partnerships, or LEPs. What impact will that have on the region's business community? The government is also busy looking to squeeze 25% from public expenditure. How will this affect Liverpool and the wider city region? Planned investment in a new bill for Liverpool Royal Hospital has been confirmed, but what about the Building Schools for the Future programme, worth over £300 million in this part of the world, and schemes such as the Second Mersey Crossing over in Halton? And what age are you happy to work until? The pension age is going up, people, like it or not, and this could have a potential impact not just on employees, but employers too. To discuss this, and I'm sure more besides, on this 4th of July, happy Independence Day to any Americans listening, I'm joined in the studio by the always eloquent John Egan from Aurora Communications, employment law and HR expert Victoria Brown from High Performance Consultancy, and a man who many think should have been pensioned off years ago, downtown events manager Roger Jonas. Good morning, all.
Hello, Frank.
It's great to see you. And can I just turn to you first, Victoria, over this issue around pensionable age? Because I think, you know, the focus almost inevitably been on the fact that pension age is going to go up, people are going to have to work longer in order for the Treasury to make some savings. But there are some real implications in there, aren't there, for employers as well?
Yeah, I think it's not just that they're actually going to go up to 66, they're actually going to remove the default retirement age. So for an employer, that means that you cannot automatically retire somebody at 65. So that will have big implications for an employer in terms of talent management, succession planning, and also wage roll. Because obviously that would be quite a substantial amount, because you would assume somebody at 65 is going to be on a lot more than somebody that's just starting out as a graduate. So, I think it's got some really big implications for the employer.
Mm. And has the government looked at this at all? Is there any legislation that you're aware of that's coming through to protect employers where people are coming to pensionable age? Are there any clear guidelines being given out at the moment as to what the situation actually is?
There's not. I mean, there was always in all the manifestos that there was going to be removal of default retirement age. And I understand that, obviously, looking at the demographics, it was always going to happen. However, there's no clear guidelines at all for employers. It's going to happen in 2011, so there's still time. But what employers really need to do now is look at their policies, also look at their performance management, rather than just thinking, OK, somebody's getting up to 65, let's just leave it until they go. Also look at potentially unfair dismissal claims, because they're going to have a really good reason for retiring that person at 65 now. And talent management is going to be a bit of a problem if you've got a change in the organisation, a change in the demographics. Then there's a lot of kind of graduate schemes, talent management, succession planning, which is going to be a bit problematic.
When you say people are going to have to be careful about unfair dismissal claims, just give you a hypothetical scenario then. You've got somebody in the workplace now who's 64, coming up to retirement. You've already started to put in place a transitional plan. You go to that person, you say to them, right, your leaving date is June the 30th, 2011. Mm-hmm. And they say to you, I don't want to go. Mm-hmm. What's your position though?
Like I said, there's no clear guidelines at the moment. So what we're saying to employers is you've got to be really careful. You've got to bear this in mind now. And you're going to have really good justification. Now, in current cases at the moment, you just can't get away with it. You need to have a really good business case for why that person needs to be retired at 65. So realistically, if you've got no audit trail, no performance management problems, then that person needs to stay within the workplace, which in some ways, and I sound quite negative, and I'm not, because I do think it's good. There's a lot of talented people that are, you know, coming up to retirement age that don't want to retire. And there are a lot of options, which a lot of employers use now anyway, you know, kind of flexible retirement, and people still stay within the workplace. But my concern is at the moment, there's not the support from the tribunal system there. And potentially, if employers do try and dismiss, as it were, will terminate their contract at 65, they're going to be an increase in unfair dismissal claims, because there's nothing there within the tribunal system to be able to manage those kinds of weak, vexatious claims. Mm.
Is this just a case of each of the political parties and the current government missing basically the implications of the legislation that they're introducing? They haven't actually thought through what they're going to do about this situation, it sounds to me.
Well, I know in the manifestos they did touch on employment tribunals, and they touched on the need to kind of look at the resources there, because quite simply, Frank, there's just not the resources there. When a claim gets submitted, there's nobody there literally to kind of sort out the weak, vexatious claim. So they just go through, and sometimes people tend to go to ACAS and a compromise agreement's drawn up and a payment made. So it has been touched on, but my concern is that they're looking at kind of the removal of the default retirement age, but they're not looking at that at the same time, and they should be looking at both at the same time.
Yeah, they should go side by side, shouldn't
Definitely.
They? Definitely. Just in the wider employment legislation field, we were promised again by all parties, but particularly by the Conservatives, that there was going to be a significant reduction in bureaucracy red tape around areas for businesses, and employment law was clearly one of those. Is there anything else coming through the pipeline at the moment that you're aware of?
Not really. I mean, they've talked about kind of one in, one out, the removal of sunset clauses, which will all be really beneficial in the future. But there's, I mean, apart from the equality bill, which was already coming through, there's nothing major in the pipeline. This is probably the biggest thing at the moment. But there are quite a few things that they're looking at, in particular kind of flexible working, which I suppose would go hand in hand with the removal of the default retirement age as well.
You say the equality bill, is that still on track then? Because I was reading somewhere last week that there were some moves within the coalition government to actually start to chip away at some of that legislation that had been planned by the Labour government.
Yeah, there is talks of kind of removal of some of it, but to be honest, it's still on track for the end of the year. It's likely to still go ahead. There might be some changes, but not anything major, really.
Okay. But clearly the focus as far as the pensionable age is concerned is on saving money to the Treasury and not necessarily on looking how it affects employers.
Definitely.
And that could be an issue in the future. Mm-hmm. And talking of saving money, Mr. Egan,
yes,
good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning, Frank.
Clearly in this part of the world, we've talked about this previously, we've had some big chunks of cash come in from the public sector, and some plan developments that we were expecting to see go ahead, obviously under review now. We'll know more in October. The big one, I suppose, is the Building Schools for the Future programme. And I think I'm right in saying that's worth about £300 million plus to the city.
£350 million plus. It's a massive investment. It's probably the biggest ever investment in schools and education, and probably in the history of Liverpool. And it would have a huge effect in terms of transforming both the physical fabric of our schools, but more importantly, the educational performance of schools.
Mm. Just in terms of the impact that may have on the Liverpool economy, should the decision go against us, what do you think we should be saying to government ministers to preserve that programme?
I think there are a whole series of arguments, and I think the educational case for BSF is a very strong and eloquent one. I think there's been a tendency to develop an economic argument which is very much based on the direct consequences. Construction sector, which has been pretty depressed, it needs these large kind of infrastructure projects to sustain itself. And if it didn't happen, lots of construction jobs and training opportunities would be jeopardised and lost. However, I don't actually think these are the arguments that are going to really cut an awful lot of ice with this government. And I think that the fundamental arguments why BSF is hugely important to Liverpool in particular are to do with the wider economic implications, the wider economic impact. I think one of the DLIB events last week, Business Week, the whole week was spectacular and hugely successful, and I think great credit to yourselves for organising it. But the meeting, the one that I was involved in, included a presentation from Elaine Russell from Cushman & Wakefield, who produced European Cities Monitor. And one of the critically important things that determines perceptions on inward investment is skills, local workforce, qualifications. If we move into this area, can we source the high quality employees, highly skilled employees that we need? And time and again, that is the most important consideration for inward investors. And historically, when inward investors have looked at Liverpool and have looked at the education system and they've looked at the outputs and the skills profile and local labour market, there have been problems. And, you know, we haven't had a competitive offer to make in terms of labour market. So I think the fundamental argument as to why BSF is important to the city, and again, going back to recent publications by Centre for Cities about, you know, cities like Liverpool have got over-dependency on public sector employment. They don't create enough private sector jobs, therefore people in Liverpool should migrate. And of course, IDS comes out of the woodwork and says, what a splendid idea, we'll make it easier for you. Get all of these Scousers down to the southeast of England where you've got a proper economy. If we're going to have a proper economy, then we need to have investment in the infrastructure that will enable the private sector to grow. Mm. And education and skills is the fundamental deficiency in the local economy. Mm. If we get that right, then local businesses can grow, our knowledge economy sector can grow, entrepreneurialism will increase and improve within the local economy. We'll create more businesses, we'll grow bigger businesses, and we'll attract businesses into the city. But if we don't get that right, then that residual over-dependence on subsidies, public sector projects, public sector interventions, an over-inflated public sector is going to continue to effectively distort the economy of the city region. So BSF is a fundamental part of economic infrastructure. It's part of the process by which we wean ourselves off public sector over-dependence and enable a private sector economy in the city region to grow and prosper.
Why do you think we still got that problem with skills gap and educational attainment? Because, you know, people listening this morning will have seen headlines saying that Liverpool's education and performance has improved significantly over the past decade. We've got some great universities in the city. Why then does that skills gap still exist, John?
Well, I think it has been improving, and I think successive city council administrations and, you know, phenomenally motivated, hardworking professional teachers have done a huge amount to turn schools around and to improve those levels of educational attainment. But it's a long hard process, and, you know, it's a long hard process that is being inhibited by culture, inhibited by, you know, social and economic problems in parts of the city, by low expectations, by the absence of role models. It becomes a self-fulfilling, you know, circle where if kids coming through schools actually don't have positive role models and there isn't an economy out there for them, then, you know, the opportunities to motivate those kids and to enable them to realise their potential is going to be inhibited by those facts. What BSF, I think, does, it enables us not only to provide kids with the best possible educational environment and teaching facilities, it also, I think, is an opportunity to radically improve the focus, the morale, the motivational environment within schools. You know, there has been underinvestment in schools for 20, 30 years. And the BSF program that was, you know, pioneered by the last Labour government was effectively about catching up. It was about looking at the quality of educational provision across the world in our competitor countries and in the developed world, and basically seeing that too many of our kids are being educated in slum schools. There are too many temporary classrooms, leaky buildings, derelict buildings, Victorian buildings, buildings not fit for use. Doesn't matter how good the teaching is, how motivated the staff are, and how charismatic the head teachers are. If the buildings themselves and the fabric and the environment is antiquated and is Victorian, not 21st century, then the outputs are going to be jeopardised and prejudiced. So it is about bringing the economy in the city region up to date, and it's vitally important that I think we develop a strong, compelling narrative that convinces the government. This isn't Liverpool saying, give us some more public money. It's Liverpool saying, we actually want to grow and develop a prosperous, thriving, sustainable private sector economy, but we've got to address those structural impediments to getting to that position.
Mm. And I think that narrative, that compelling narrative you talk about, has to be a joint approach, doesn't it? It can't just be the local authority and Labour MPs banging on the door.
No, I think
it needs to include the private sector.
Absolutely
too.
Right. I think the business community, when, you know, if it's politicians telling the government we need this because our businesses cannot grow, they cannot reach their potential because our citizens, our young citizens are not reaching their potential, then I think it needs to be business leaders who are amplifying and validating that message. And it's brilliant that, you know, so many business leaders who've been engaged in the BSF programme immediately understand and get the logic and buy into that and are coming forward now to advocate and to be part of the lobbying process to convince government this is one bit of investment that is absolutely vital for the city region.
Well, one thing that isn't going to be saved are the regional development agencies and Business Link. And we at Downtown Liverpool have been big supporters of both organisations over the past few years. We think that they've done a sterling job, particularly in the recession. Business Link played a formidable role in advising lots of businesses, ensuring that they were able to access the cash that they needed to keep going. And I was disappointed that that announcement was made by the Chancellor during his budget speech, because prior to the general election, the Conservatives and indeed the Liberal Democrats had stated that they were going to consult with the wider business communities in each of the regions before a final decision was taken. It seems to me the political dogma has got in the way here. And Eric Pickles, who's the Minister for Local Government and Communities, is relishing the task of axing what he sees as unnecessary quangos, actually made a speech earlier this week saying that he wasn't going to talk about regional development agencies because he didn't like to speak ill of the dead. I didn't think that was a particularly nice way of dealing with, let's face it, cuts which are going to affect people's lives. And whether you agree with what the agencies and similar organisations do or not, I think you should be handling these issues with far more sensitivity. But that doesn't seem to be part of Mr. Pickles' makeup. I'll be surprised if Conservative councillors get on particularly well with him, never mind Labour and Lib Dems. But Roger, we've done a lot of work with the development agency and with Business Link. Disappointing news?
I think it's very disappointing news. It's something that they've been prepared for. You know, they've known that the funding that's going to be available will be limited in the years to come. And I think what they're looking at now is really how to manage the mechanism of the transition between the NWDA and creating LEPs. Mm. It's something that's high on their agenda. You know, they've got to look at the boundaries and obviously decide the respective roles of the local authorities and business. And I think Pickles and his comments, you know, I think he's totally not taking into account the sensitivity of the number of people who are possibly going to lose their jobs.
Mm. I think the other problem with the way this decision was announced is that by Thursday of last week, people were actually thinking the Business Link had already gone. And people like Steve Hennigan, who operates in Merseyside, who have a difficult enough task in terms of engaging with businesses effectively, he was taking phone calls from some of his clients saying, awfully sorry to hear that that you've been made redundant. This is a two-year transitional process, and I think the government, again, you know, really should have been clearer in outlining what the strategy was. And of course, the local economic partnerships that they're talking about developing will take time to bed in. And indeed, in places like Lancashire and probably here on Merseyside, there's going to be an awful lot of discussion needed to see how those LEPs are going to be configured, because we don't have local government that operates in a coordinated fashion in this part of the world. Greater Manchester will probably be able to get their act together relatively quickly. But elsewhere, I doubt, firstly, whether we have the capacity to be able to deliver economic development within the local government structures that we currently have. And secondly, whether or not actually this is all a little bit of a bluff, because not only are the organisations going to disappear, but the money's going to go as well. Mm. So the LEPs are actually going to be operating with very, very little support financially.
Yeah, yeah. And I think what's encouraging, though, at the same time, is the support from regional businesses who have written to the government, who have identified their support and acknowledged their support for the RDAs. And obviously that's got to have some sway. It has to be listened to in terms of what the Regional Development, Northwest Regional Development Agency have achieved. I mean, we've said this before, for every pound they have spent, the economic benefit return is £5.20. In essence, the tangible amount is that they've turned 5.3 billion into £23 billion. Mm. And I think that's their evidence enough. And that's obviously why there's immense support. And it's from the likes of the Greater Manchester authorities, Bibby's, Bentley, the Mando Group, Peel, Unilever. I mean, these, and United Utilities, these are big, big businesses that are showing their support. And I think, I mean, Louise Ellman, she in a government debate, I mean, she's questioned why Vince Cable is wanting to abolish this. It's going to happen. He maintains now that he's personally met with the Northwest Development Agency, and they've got to accept that change is going to happen. It's going to start. You were talking about people's confusion here, talking about when all this is going to kick in. The government have announced their intention to replace the RDAs and encourage the development of local enterprise partnerships. That process starts with a white paper, which is going to be published later this summer. So that's when it all kicks in. And you know, the NWDA have been preparing for this for a long time because they understand that change is inevitable. The RDAs are going to be restructured, and now it's about the relationship that they're going to have and identifying that, the boundaries, and basically what they're going to have to do is partner more with local businesses to do more for less.
Mm. I mean, they have taken a massive hit on the budget from immediate effect, and I know that that will impact on some big infrastructure projects across the region. Some have been saved, some are under review at the moment. But I suppose it's a case of watch this space and wait and see. I'm hoping to be able to speak to the chief executive of the Northwest Development Agency, Steve Broomhead, over the summer. So I'm sure that we'll get further clarification from him. But as I say, I think in terms of business support, maybe this will be seen as the months and years roll on as the coalition government's first major mistake. More politics after the break, as we talk to the new leader of Joe Anderson and his decision to undertake the role on a full-time basis. See you after the break.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
Welcome back to the show, and I'm delighted that I'm now joined on the telephone by Joe Anderson, the leader of Liverpool City Council. Good morning, Joe.
Hi, good morning, Frank.
You've been causing a few headlines of your own this week, sir, this decision of yours to go full-time. Now, I recall that was a pledge that you'd made a fairly long time ago now, I think, even before this last election. I think you'd made your intentions clear. Why all the fuss?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, over 2 years ago now, we put it into our pledges, our commitment, because I believe that the city needed full-time leadership in terms of quality leadership that could, do the things that need to be done for the city. I think the fuss is clearly a political sort of spat, if you like, by the former administration, who are claiming that I have manipulated this and deceived people in terms of taking an increase in allowance and trying to make out that, other people... ironically, they're saying that the public sector workers are receiving no increase in pay, of course, inflicted by their own government. But it's something that I believe is a pledge that I made that we should keep, and I think it's the right thing to do. The independent members panel looked at this, and these are people who are not councillors, but ordinary people from different walks of life, from the private sector, from the public sector, from the voluntary sector, you know, ordinary people who've looked at this, and they decided that previously that worked part-time 2.5 days and received an allowance of 21,000. And they've said that given that I'm working 5 days, they've doubled that to 42,000. You know, that's their decision based on seeing how hard I've been working and what I've been doing, and the programme that I've set myself in terms of taking on the responsibilities of housing and also taking on the responsibilities of business, you know, in terms of business improvements and enterprise within the city. They've decided that that's the right thing to do.
I think there'll be a lot of business leaders listening to this morning, Joe, thinking 42,000. Mm-hmm. Are you sure that's enough?
Well, it's sad, isn't it, Frank, that I had to go public on what I earned and tell people because of, you know, political opportunism. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, I perversely could work part-time, and my school would be delighted to even have me half part-time, they've said that. Perversely, I could work part-time, receive my salary that I get from school of £40,000, and receive the allowance as leader of £21,000, and of £21,000 plus the £10,000 that I would receive as a councillor, and that totals £71,000. So I'm actually losing £19,000. And you know, I think that anybody that attacks me, knowing that, you know, deserve a boot up the backside, quite frankly, because, you know, my wife said to me when I tried to keep all of this away from her, you know, in terms of not letting her know.
And she said, blame you.
Yeah, she said to me,
she said, are you mad?
Yeah, £19,000 we're losing. You didn't tell that. You didn't mention that to me. And so, it quite frankly, it's annoyed me that you know, I've had to reveal, you know, my personal details to people in a way that I shouldn't, quite frankly, have had to do. But you know, I'm comfortable with the decision. I'm determined to work full time for the city, and I think, you know, the announcements that will be getting made and the things that I'll be doing. I know people will judge what the performance of myself over 12 months, and you know, they can decide. The electorate can decide next May. But what I intend to do, Frank, just to let the public know, is I intend to make sure that my diary is fully produced in terms of, so people can see the amount of work and what I'm doing, and I will put that on the internet, on the council's internet and internet site, so members of the public can see my diary. I mean, an example is last week I worked something like 67 hours, and the week before that, again, you know, well in excess of 50 hours, and I will let people know exactly what I'm doing, so they can judge for themselves whether they're getting value for money from me.
Mm. To move on to the more positive part of this agenda, as you know, we as an organisation at Downtown Liverpool have been calling for a full-time political leader at Liverpool City Council for 4 or 5 years now, so we were well behind this move, and it wasn't a party political pronouncement. You know, we encouraged Warren to do likewise, and Mike Storey before that. But what the business community is saying to me is two things, really. More visibility from the council leader and more accessibility. And really, if that's maintained over the period, then I don't think it's just value for money. I think it's more than value for money. And, you know, for me, if you're going to run a city like Liverpool, and Liverpool is going to be taken seriously, then it's going to have political leadership. It can't simply be run by officials who are appointed by councillors, and councillors acting simply as scrutineers.
Well, that's exactly right, and the point is that's one of the criticisms that the former leader of the council made was that officers run the council. He said, well, I'm sorry, in the council that I lead as the elected leader, it's the politicians that run the council. Officers advise and councillors decide, and that's the way it will be under my tenure as leader, as short or as long as that lasts. And the fact of the matter is that I've been literally inundated with calls from businesses supporting the decision, but telling me it's the right thing to do. You know, I had a meeting here last week where a serious player in terms of the development of this city, you know, a chief executive said to me, Joe, I've been in this city 8 years. He said, never once have I been in the leader's office. And that was, another one said to me, again, sitting at the same meeting, that he was absolutely delighted that they were getting the opportunity to talk to us and have an open door policy, but also that they were getting clear direction and political leadership in terms of what it is we as a city wanted to do with them and how we were going to work with them. So I'm comfortable with what I've done, and it's a shame really that, as I said, you know, we've had to have this very public spat where I've had to reveal the financial details. But I think people will see that that's the old politics, and that's what they voted to get rid of. And this is a new politics. This is about pragmatic leadership. This is about real, mature, sensible leadership that's taken our city to the next level, to develop our city and create more jobs and opportunities and a better city for everybody. And that's what I intend to do. And you can only do that. You can only do that full time. And if Warren Bradley was honest about it, and Mike Storey, both of them had my support if that's what they wanted to do, because I said it to them on many occasions. Mm. And, you know, whether they want to reveal that or what they want to do, that's entirely up to themselves. To be honest with you, Frank, I'm getting on with doing what I'm doing and running the city, and I'm not going to engage any more in it now. It's done and dusted, but as far as I'm concerned, it's very regrettable, but there you go. Mm.
Well, moving on, Joe, and part of the agenda, obviously, that you're going to have to consider, and a big part of any local authority's role, is education. Mm-hmm. And the Building Schools for the Future programme, we were talking earlier about that being worth in excess of £350 million to the city. Mm-hmm. Can I just bring John Egan in at this juncture? John, we were saying earlier about the importance of the private sector being involved in the campaign to retain that cash here. Just want to explain a little bit about your thought process on that whilst Joe's on the line, and then get his reaction.
Yeah, just as I said to Frank earlier, Joe, I think the fundamental case for Building Schools for the Future is this is public money that will be absolutely vital to the city in its long-term ambitions to renew its economy and to provide conditions in which businesses can grow and prosper, we can attract more inward investment, and we can see more businesses created and formed in the city through young entrepreneurs because of the investment we're making in improving schools and improving educational output. There's a short-term economic argument in terms of construction and investment, but a long-term economic argument in terms of how it will improve the business environment in the city. And you know, it's been really encouraging in discussions between the BSF team and City Council with business leaders, that business leaders have been almost queuing up to come forward and underscore that point. Mm-hmm. And strongly support the political lobby that you and your colleagues and the City MPs are, the fight that they're fighting with respect to trying to ensure this investment isn't lost.
Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely crucial that we all work together to ensure that the BSF Wave 6 programme goes ahead. You're absolutely right. There's two important factors here. One is for the short term, in terms of it helps keep the construction sector and the supply industries going at a time of economic difficulty for us all, and when we've got the downturn that we're currently facing. And that's the first aspect, and it's absolutely vital that happens. And the second point, of course, is that as you rightly say, this is about making sure that our education facilities are fit for the 21st century, fit for purpose, and can provide industry, businesses, new technologies, you know, the bioscience industry, the creative industry sector, the financial services sectors, which we're trying to attract into the city. We can get the skilled young people ready and available to work in those sectors because, you know, look, we can go to Shanghai, we can go to places where we're encouraging investors to come to our city, but one of the things that they want to know is how we are preparing for their investments and how we are preparing for their businesses and our schools together with our universities and our colleges, but together with the city council and the private sector, have to make sure that we are planning for that. And part of that, which underpins the success of our city for the future, is to make sure that we've got, again, schools that are not only fit for purpose, but innovative, creative and forward-thinking in how we respond to the investment that we're going to get.
Mm. Joe, you mentioned the Shanghai Expo there, and I know that at our Business Week event last week, you were talking about the pavilion potentially being used as a London embassy, almost. Have those plans been progressed any, or is that just something that you're thinking about at the moment?
No, they are getting progressed. It's something that I'm determined will happen, and it's going to be a Liverpool embassy in London.
Sorry, a London embassy in Liverpool.
Yeah, well, we could possibly work on that, see if they want to send a London embassy into Liverpool. But we've certainly got space for them. But no, I mean, it is something that I'm keen to make happen. And obviously, the difficult financial circumstances that we're all operating in now. But I'm fairly confident that we can make this happen, working with private sector partners. And I'm confident that we will achieve that because I've invested in the pavilion, in all of the hardware that makes up the pavilion. You know, I don't want to see this locked up in a warehouse and not used again. I want to see it used, and it's something I'm determined to make happen because I believe that, you know, investors and developers in the capital will see the opportunities. But it won't just be, as I said, Frank, part of it having that facility there, that embassy there, that Liverpool embassy there. We will then look to bring people who are interested in investment opportunities, development opportunities. We will bring them here to our city, show them the fantastic facilities we've got, let them have a tangible sort of experience, talking to people, seeing the sites themselves. So that's all part of the vision, if you like, and it's something that I want to make happen.
Good news as far as Liverpool's concerned, and again, I know that particular move has got an awful lot of support across the business community. But another issue that come to the fore this week was the future of regional development agencies, or rather the lack of future of regional development agencies. I'd just like to get your take on that, Joe, because I know you've been a big supporter of the Northwest Agency in the past.
Yeah, I think it's disappointing but inevitable in the sense that, you know, the government's already made its commitment to abolish RDAs, and you know, we got a bit of respite for a month where they said they were going to look at it, and we hope that we'd be able to make the case that the Northwest Development Agency was saved. We haven't been able to do that despite its excellent record in terms of supporting Liverpool, but supporting the, you know, obviously the regional development. And I think it's going to be a great loss. However, you know, we have to deal with the cards that were dealt, and the government are saying that, you know, there will be an opportunity for the sub-region to prepare what they are calling LEPs, which is local enterprise partnerships, and I am already in discussions with our regional partners and the private sector to put forward a proposal, a bid for a local enterprise partnership, which I'm confident we will have ready for the 6th of September deadline. Again, perversely, you know, we're being asked to, by government, put in a bid for a LEP without having seen the white paper which gives you an explanation of what it is they're supposed to be doing. So it's a little bit of a stab in the dark. But what we've got to say, I think, is set out what we think government can do to assist us in the city region, develop and cut some of the bureaucracy and red tape in planning and other areas, but give us the opportunity to say to government, this is what we want you to do for us. And, you know, Manchester, Greater Manchester, are going to be putting in their own LEP bid and along with other regions. So sort of a regional LEP, if you like, to replace the NWDA seems to be off the cards. But, you know, that's what they're offering us, these LEPs.
So it'll be a city-region model, Joe, will it?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's, there's no way that, Liverpool should enter this on its own. We've got to work together and we've got to, I think, have a new way of thinking about, all of the districts that make up the city region, working in genuine, as I said, collaboration with each other, and that's what we intend to do. We've got to learn lessons from the past of how not working together and squabbling, sends investment away and means we actually miss out on opportunities. And there's a determination from me as the new leader of the City Regional Cabinet to make sure that we have an approach that is a genuine partnership and a genuine equal stake in the development of the region. So whilst it's sad that NWDA is going to go, as I said, out of those situations come opportunities, and I think there's an opportunity for us to strengthen our partnership together with the districts, and realign ourselves if people want to go off somewhere else or whatever, the districts. But we need to take this opportunity to put together a strong local enterprise partnership based, on the city regional board and governance and move forward.
Before you go, Joe, can I just ask the other significant post within the City Council that's vacant at the moment is that of Chief Executive. Can you just give listeners an update as to where we're up to on the process for that particular position?
Yeah, I think I've been doing that job as well as me all for a number of weeks. But I'm setting up what we call an appointments panel soon. Another week, there is one existing, and I'll set up a meeting with that, and there'll be a number of issues going to that, and one of them will be we go to advert and start bringing in people who will encourage people to headhunters to look at people to fill that role, and I hope to hopefully have somebody in place by December. So we're starting that process. I think, from my point of view, we need the right person, the right qualities, not specific to one area, but somebody who can look at the city with me about facing its challenges, but also looking with, as I said, the same passion as me about, the development of the city through. Basically through business and through regeneration, and I think I want them to have a solid foundation in business and regeneration and the other things. I think we've got a reasonably good, strong team that can actually deliver on those things. I'm sure you'll have also heard about the performance-related pay of senior officers in the council, and I'm sure you'll have read yesterday about the announcement of the officers here giving up the performance-related pay, which is absolutely welcomed by me. They knew that I was determined to make sure that the only incentivisation that they needed was to work on behalf of the people of this city and for the good of the city. And I'm delighted to say that their refusal to accept performance-related pay and to have it taken out of their contract is a welcome sign to the people of this city that we're in a partnership, we're in a real team, and we're all working together. So that's another positive coming from the City Council.
Joe, on that positive note, I will let you go. Thanks for joining us this morning. I think, given the comments you were making earlier, you owe Mrs. Anderson a good Sunday lunch. So I'll let you get back to it.
Thanks very much, Frank.
Thanks for your time.
Good morning. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Well, that was Joe Anderson, the leader of Liverpool City Council, just giving us his views on going full-time and also the other issues that we've been discussing earlier this morning on City Talk 105.9. Interesting there, Vic. He was talking about his officers, his senior officers, basically saying that performance-related pay, that they're going to forego it. Be nice if you could get that introduced into some of the companies that you advise, I'm sure. Yeah. Once that's in a contract, how easy is it to remove it?
Well, obviously, it's down to negotiation with the employees. And given the state of the economy at the moment, if you've got a good reason to remove that, a good business case, then yeah, you can do that. Mm. As you said, it's sometimes a little bit more difficult if you haven't got the support from your officers, which Joe has got, which is very helpful in that respect. And I'm sure when things improve, you can obviously look at that again and look at your rewards. But I actually don't necessarily think the performance-related pay is potentially the best form of reward anyway.
Mm. What alternatives are there to that then? What do you see other people offering in terms of, is it commissions or is it mostly people looking for decent salary now?
To be honest, Frank, I think obviously salary is important and people need to be paid and need to pay their bills. But when you actually look at the statistics, when you say about kind of a pay increase, it's forgotten within a couple of weeks. It's more the fringe benefits and the team morale, motivation, employee engagement. I think that's what's more important, which all sounds a bit airy-fairy, but if you actually look at it, it will make a big difference to your workforce rather than just looking at pay increases.
And a business is getting better at that sort of stuff now because it is relatively new to the business culture in the UK, isn't it? That sort of thing, that approach.
I've found probably over the last couple of years, because they've had to have pay freezes, then businesses have started to look at this a little bit more and started to think, right, okay, well, we can't look at a pay increase. So you have your yearly performance review and your 3% rise. So I think companies are warming towards that more now and seeing the results from good communication, staff engagement and fringe benefits that don't necessarily cost the company a lot of money.
Mm. I mean, Joe was very praiseworthy of the officers making that decision to forego the performance-related pay, John. But I think in Joe Anderson, there's quite a persuasive character there. I'm sure the negotiation would have been an interesting one. I wish I'd have been a fly on the wall.
Somewhere in the recesses of my memory of history lessons is the example of Admiral Byng, who the British Navy put to the sword after he lost a battle, and Voltaire wittily observed, "It was done pour encourager les autres." And I think Joe has made certain gestures since his coming to power, which I think have helped to create a climate in which officers understand the new pragmatism.
Mm. And it is a positive move,
it is,
isn't it, from
positive.
The city's perspective?
And I think
sure.
It demonstrates real commitment and passion by officers to get behind the new administration's project.
Mm. What did you make of his comments on RDAs and this idea of the city regions coming together to form a local economic partnership?
Well, I was massively encouraged, impressed by Joe's pragmatism. There are two words that go with Joe Anderson: it's passion and pragmatism. There's no point fighting a war over the decision that's being made. There's a new dispensation, there's a new reality there, and we've got to grasp and the opportunities and come to face to face with that. So I think the fact that they're so quick off the mark with the LEP approach is very encouraging for the city. You know, we've got to start being first. We've got to start being at the front of the queue, being the most enthusiastic, the most constructive, the most imaginative in how we respond to these sorts of situations.
Absolutely.
Which I think is brilliant. The thing I would like to somehow throw into the mix is that it does possibly present us with an opportunity to rethink where the city region actually begins and ends. Because once upon a time, under the RDA dispensation, we had to kind of think within this artificially constructed box called the Northwest. And perhaps we had to think in terms of the old kind of structures of local authorities and counties. it seems a bit mad that Ellesmere Port and Vauxhall's is not part of our city region. It seems a bit mad that Warrington's not part of our city region. It seems a bit mad that Deeside and North Wales aren't a part of our city region. In real terms, they are. They're part of the same economic entity. And if it's a local enterprise partnership as opposed to a local government construct, then I think its boundaries should reflect the boundaries of the city region economy, not the city region's local authority jurisdictions. Yeah. Is there any scope, I hope, or wonder, within the new structure for us to kind of reclaim bits of our hinterland, which we've had, you know, have been outside of the jurisdiction of any of the city regional structures?
Yeah, it's an interesting point, that, actually, because we often do get ourselves trapped into these, as you say, false economic boundaries.
Yeah.
When, you know, most people in North Wales see Liverpool as the city that they would most easily relate to. And we're discouraged, actually, aren't we, from having conversations across the border in that way at this moment in time. Yeah. So perhaps you're right, that perhaps there is an opportunity.
And I can't
there.
See that the people of North Wales get an awful lot out of the Welsh Development Agency historically. I mean, it's got a small outpost in St Asaph, but, I mean, that's little more than a sort of than a kind of token, I think, in terms of what is very much a Cardiff-centred body. Mm. And likewise, you know, Cheshire West, as it now is, you know, it's a unitary authority that should have more autonomy in terms of where it positions itself. Chester, Ellesmere Port, you know, they're fundamentally part of our city region. All the
synergies,
media organisations, City, yep. Daily Post, Trinity Mirror titles, there is a community of interest that extends beyond the six authorities, which I think is a...
Just quickly, John, whilst we're on the city region agenda, the second crossing... I think most people's prediction is that's going to end up in the bin.
It doesn't look good, does it? It doesn't look good. No final decision has been made. And Tony McDermott was trying to be upbeat a couple of weeks ago when the announcement was made and was trying to sort of bolster the potential to rescue the project. But, you know, I think the body language from government is that this is a big capital project and they don't really grasp, understand or support the strategic need for it. And maybe, you know, maybe Tony and maybe the city region needs to be pragmatic in rethinking, is there another way in which we can do this? If there's a compelling need for a road crossing to relieve pressure on the existing bridge, which there obviously is there a lower cost alternative? Is there a green alternative? You know, can it be combined with some form of tidal facility, refloat the idea of the barrage with a road on top, a low-level bridge with a swing bridge across the canal would cost a fraction of a high-level bridge, and it may have just the same amount of local transport benefits. I think we should be thinking laterally. I think we should be sort of accepting that we need a plan B. By all means, keep up the campaign, fight hard for plan A, but if we don't get it, the idea that the existing bridge could be out of commission for major refurb in years to come, and the city completely log jammed is just unthinkable.
Clearly, lots of challenges ahead, lots of debates and discussion to be had, and we'll be looking at those issues in the coming weeks ahead, I'm sure. That's the end of our time on City Talk Business with me, Frank McKenna. I thank my guests, Roger Jonas, John Egan, Victoria Brown, and of course, Joe Anderson, the leader of Liverpool City Council. A big thanks to you guys for listening. I'll see you all again next week. Have a great week and don't do anything I wouldn't do.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9. City Talk 105.9. Official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm.